Hello and welcome to another edition of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we are here with Mr. Stephen Arians, who is a pharmacist practicing in Southern Indiana. He also runs a very widely read blog that you can catch him on, which we can discuss later. But the name of the blog is Steve Arians, PD Pharmacist. And with that, I would like to welcome Steve to the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Well, I'm glad you invited me, but the blog is pharmaciststeve.com, just for clarification purposes.
Okay, thank you. I apologize for that. So, Steve, tell us a little bit about how you got involved as an advocate in the opiate epidemic. Often you see pharmacists really trying to stay out of some of the policy and politics of the opiate epidemic, but you seem to be taking the opposite course and getting actively involved. Can you tell us your story?
Well, my wife is a chronic pain, an intractable chronic pain patient. She has been there for some 30 odd years. And so I've had to walk both sides of the fence with the problems and benefits of opiate medications. And I have ran up against some physicians who have been rather obstinate, and finally got in a position where the physicians are understanding and promptly treating her. And so I became probably the most poignant point in my life was back in the mid 80s. I had a young gentleman who was a patient at my independent pharmacy. And this is back before we had PDMPs. And he seemed to have a lot of accidents. He seemed to have a fondness for Darvocetin 100s. And one day he came in, we never could really narrow him down as being a problem or not. And he came in one day with a drug card, you know, where somebody, before that he was paying cash for his prescriptions. And he showed up with this drug card, PBM is what we call them now, and tried to process his prescription. And they came back and denied it and said he'd gotten the same thing a few days earlier at another pharmacy. I called the PBM, and after much beating on them, they told me where he got it at. And like a conscientious pharmacist, I called the other doctor in the other pharmacy, and we pretty went to PBM and cut him off. A few days later, I got to attend his funeral. Wow. After he took a 38 to his head. That changed my perspective on pain and addiction, and he was obviously somewhere on the fence on both sides of the fence, because when you talk to people who have an addiction, usually get the phrase when you ask them, why are you taking this? And they'll say, I like the way it made me feel. And what it comes down to is they have some degree, minor or major, of an addictive personality. And they are never realized they had demons in their heads and monkeys on their backs. And when they interact with an opiate or other substance, alcohol, that silences those, they enter a mentally a different world for them, and they like the silence.
Yeah.
And so I've seen this evolution, and more medical healthcare professionals seem to be realizing that it is a complex medical issue, a health issue, mental health issue. I'm sorry, I get this straight. And so I started this blog about 10 years ago, really not knowing where I was going to go with it. And it has evolved into being very pro opiate therapy. I apparently have law firms that are reading it, and physicians who are reading it, and chronic pain patients are reading it, and pharmacists are reading it.
Yeah, it's definitely considered a point of reference for many in the pain community and substance use dependency community. You mentioned that the blog had evolved to become, as you said, pro-opioid therapy. It clearly seems like that was not by design, that it simply evolved in that direction. Can you talk us through the evolution of your blog and the moment you realized, hey, I'm positioning myself in a certain way in this whole complex issue of the opioid epidemic?
Well, the original concept was designed is how our healthcare system is harming us. Because, you know, historically, it's been reported that the third largest cause of death behind cardiovascular and cancer, and I forget which one of those are one or two, but they're always is medical errors. You know, the health system kills the third largest killer of people. And as people reached out to me, the ones who mostly reach out to me are chronic pain patients. I had one this morning. I had an email from a person who the pharmacy was getting more and more obstinate about filling his, didn't say it, but I presume C2s, because he didn't live in the same county as the pharmacy.
Right.
And the DEA has determined through their observations of what substance abusers, addicts, diverters do is they travel long distances to get a prescriber or a pharmacy to fill opiates. I've had worst case scenarios over the year. One person told me this, a particular chain store refused to fill her C2 because she lived in a different zip code than the store, but come to find out, she lived a half a mile from the store, but there was a zip code line between her house and the store.
Unbelievable. You know, that's a really interesting point you mentioned, because the DEA does have these kind of system of checks. They kind of like to call them as red flags, and distance apparently is one of them. And it seems to make sense, but as you alluded to, there's as many exceptions as there are actual adherence to that particular checkpoint. What are you noticing about these DEA observations that have changed, that have worked, and that are potentially just misguided?
Well, my opinion is most of the DEA red flags are what they've observed of what substance abuser addicts or diverters do. You know, they say that there is no valid medical need for taking an opiate, a benzo, and a muscle relaxer, because that's the holy trinity for street addicts is OxyContin and Soma and Xanax, called the holy trinity. But the DEA doesn't observe that these three medications are taken in very large doses, in very large quantities. And so they've taken the person who takes a handful of these at a time and said, well, there must not be any valid medical need because they died. Well, right. The person who takes those, you know, benzodiazepine to sleep at night and an opiate and a muscle relaxer during the day to manage their pain during the day is not the same person as that who takes a handful.
Yeah. But why is that? Why do they fail to understand the clinical context and simply just focus on the pills themselves? What do you think this reason for that is?
A lot of the bureaucracies have agendas. And I really think that they are trying to, I was working in a pharmacy. It was right before I got my degree and my license, when the Controlled Substance Act was passed. I've had a front row seat to the evolution of from when the Federal Narcotic Act was repealed which had a $2 million budget, and the BNDD was created through the Controlled Substances Act, the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, which had, I think, 1,200 employees and a $42 million budget, which in 73 evolved into the what we know as DEA today.
Mm-hmm.
It is and today my understanding is there's 12,000 people at the federal level working for the DEA, and over half of them are sitting at a desk. We don't know how many people are involved in the war on drugs at the city, county, and state levels. When you really think about it, the cop on the city street, the county cop, the local judges, the local prosecutors, the local district or local defense attorneys, to some degree, are all involved in the war on drugs.
Right.
Some claim there's close to $100 billion a year spent on the war on drugs. We really don't know. We don't know the number of people that are partially or totally involved. To me, there would be a very simplistic way to put a dent in the legal diverting or doctor shopping or pharmacy shopping. A very easy way. The TSA uses a system called clearme.com, and it is an identification system based on digital facial and digital fingerprints. And when you first register with that system, if you walk in and it you put in your fingerprints and it shoots your facial ID and you say, "I am Mickey Mouse," every time you walk up to that to a console, you are Mickey Mouse. And what would happen if most healthcare professionals or all healthcare professionals had such a terminal when they walked in and said, "I'm Donald Duck," and they said, "No, you registered as Mickey Mouse. You're trying to misrepresent who you are." Why would you prescribe for that person?
Right.
Same thing with the pharmacy. And you could link that system only creates a digital, probably a 64-bit or 128-bit ID. If you link that ID to electronic medical records or the PDMPs or pharmacy databases or what have you, when they logged in, the system would know by the MAC address on the terminal where they're at and could send that ID to that store's, that office's electronic medical records, and whatever was put in the electronic medical records is, I want a PMDP pulled up. And all of a sudden, the doctor, the pharmacist gets a report.
Interesting. So the DEA has tried some attempts to automate, and you have alluded to the PDMPs a few times. What do you see is a disadvantage to this system of integration? Because what you're alluding to is kind of have an integrated identification system, which would be a smart, simple solution connecting physicians to pharmacists. But the DEA seems to create its own kind of data infrastructure platform. Can you explain what the DEA is trying to do, and in your experience, why that's kind of missing the point?
I think the DEA comes out every few years and changes the lipstick color on the pig and says, "Well, this pig's better and it'll work." And it really will not. It's the same pig. But they claim it's in my impression of our bureaucracies, and whether it's city, county, state, or federal, and federal in particular, is the bureaucrat's primary charge is to perpetuate and grow the bureaucracy. And yeah. So, they know IDs are forged. If you go to any web search on the web and say, how do I get a fake driver's license? The last time I got that, I got over 6 million responses. And if you figure that 99.999% are fake or duplicates, you still have 600 possible valid sites.
Right.
So
the prescription forgeries and false prescriptions are a major issue. What about those patients who have legitimate prescriptions, but they struggle to get them at the pharmacy either because the pharmacist is not filling for them or the insurance decides not to cover that particular medication? What are you seeing now as an issue with legitimate prescription prescriptions?
And this is predominantly a problem with the chain drug stores, as I see them. To fill a C2 in particular, it takes about twice as much pharmacist time to do the administration of filling a C2 than any other prescription. The chains seem to not care much if their pharmacists fill or not fill controlled substances. If they don't fill them, that's less aggravation with the potential aggravation with the DEA. And they got so damn much business that they don't mind, you know, the fines from the DEA if they get caught doing something, not dotting an I, not crossing a T, the fines could take away whatever profits they made out of selling them. So, you know, the pharmacists are, I think, unduly scared of losing their license. And they've discovered that the patient can file a complaint with the corporate headquarters, file it with the pharmacy board, and file it with the insurance company, and they'll all tell you, we can't force the pharmacist to fill a prescription, which is correct. But the pharmacy doesn't have to keep that person on staff if they're unhappy with them turning them down. The pharmacy board could call them before a meeting and say, please explain the clinical reasons you rejected this prescription. And the insurance company could threaten the pharmacy with canceling their contract. So the pharmacists, these pharmacists have discovered, you know, if I say no, there's no repercussions.
Right. Now, a lot of that has to come with the changing definition of diversion. And something that you clearly have noted in your decades personally and as an advocate leading your blog, do you mm-hmm. feel that a lot of these changes have occurred because of the change in the definition of diversion?
Diversion from legitimate sources is, I think, becoming, from a prescription standpoint, I mean, diversion from employees stealing stuff from hospitals or pharmacies or what have you, or nursing homes in those kind of settings, it probably is pretty much unchanged. But the diversion from forged prescriptions and bulk doctor shopping and pharmacy shopping is greatly reduced. Opiate prescriptions peaked in 2011, 2012. Since then, the DEA has reduced the production quotas of the pharmas for controls by around 50% or more. So the opiates aren't there for the pharmacist to dispense or the doctor to write for them, even when they do write for them. And the wholesalers, at the bequest of the DEA, have started rationing controls to pharmacies, which is a violation of the Interstate Commerce Act. But since, you know, when you have a part of the Department of Justice telling you to violate a law, you pretty much go along with them.
Right.
So it's, as I said, there's so many employees, so much money going into people's pockets for fighting the war on drugs, that it would be heresy for anybody to suggest that we change the program or the processes that would reduce, you know, the legal legal opiates being prescribed and dispensed.
But Steve, as you've noted, so many patients, and the voices are getting louder and louder, call for a certain level of autonomy. They want to resume that relationship with the physician without, quote unquote, big brother, be it from the CDC to DEA, overlooking their shoulder. So how do you reconcile then the need for this oversight, which is needed at the end of the day, with this level of autonomy that patients are calling for, that you have personally attested to, is something is necessary for good patient care?
We're having, my perception of the younger healthcare professionals across the board, nurses, mid-levels, physicians, pharmacists, is they've all been educated to work off of lab values.
Right.
And when you're dealing with subjective diseases, pain, anxiety, depression, ADD, ADHD, and various mental health issues, there are no values. You either believe the patient in what they say, or you don't. There's no checklist. If somebody's blood pressure is more than 135 over 85, you start talking about medication. If their cholesterol is above 200, 240, 250, whatever, you start talking about medication. Their blood sugar is above 120, 140, or their A1C is above 6, you start talking about medication. And on down the line you go. But when the patient says, I ache, I have pain, you're too young to have pain. Take some NSAIDs, take some Tylenol. Well, okay, you take enough, you end up screwing up your liver or your kidneys. I've got a chart on my blog and the resources that lists all the comorbidity issues, complications that are potential if somebody from under untreated pain. I hear from patients, well, the doctor reduced my dose and all of a sudden my blood pressure is 200 over 100 and he's given me 3 or 4 different blood pressure medication and isn't budging, but it all came from my reduction in my pain medicines.
Right.
Which is an obvious diagnostic, to me, a diagnostic indication. I was always taught you don't throw more meds to treat side effects of something.
Yeah.
It's bad medicine.
It is bad medicine. And I think a lot of the bad medicine comes from oversimplifying broad trends, like the number of opioid prescriptions, the opioid mortality. Can you go through these trends in detail and really kind of identify points in which at a policy level, we just misunderstood the data?
I have seen the DEA used to put out, this doctor was rated in so many million prescriptions and so many patients over this period of time. And I would reverse engineer the numbers and going, okay, the average patient got one dose every 2 days. Where's the push? But they've stopped doing that. I don't know if I caused that or what.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, now they just go, there's so many millions of doses, and they may use a time frame, but patient numbers aren't involved. I see a lot of doctors getting rated, and most of them are 50 plus. Which suggests they've got their house paid for and their student loans paid for and probably a decent start on a retirement fund. And the DEA wants to come in. And the DEA, in my opinion, start with an opinion, raid the office, get all the medical records, and then build a case off of a few patients on some subjective and calculated facts.
Yeah, so it's essentially reinterpreting the patient-physician encounter to concoct criminality.
And thereafter to use the civil asset forfeiture law to seize all the assets, and they see that all they shut the practice down, they seize all his assets, his or her assets, and they go, okay, Doc, how are you going to defend yourself? You want a legal aid attorney?
Yeah. Good luck with that.
But the Dodgers could protect themselves if they would pay attention. If before the DEA vultures start circling, they need to put all their assets into two irrevocable trusts. An irrevocable trust, the person who creates a trust cannot benefit from the trust.
Right.
So they need to start two of them. Husband, I'm old fashioned, so excuse my vocabulary. The husband creates one for the wife creates one for the husband.
Right.
So they're and the trustee is told you don't pay any DEA fines or anything else, and they could go to jail if they did. So I really believe if the truth was known, the DEA has spreadsheets on physicians on the number of controlled substances they write and prescribe and are dispensed, and their estimated net worth, and they're sorted. And whoever has the highest net worth and they can come down with the highest number of controlled substances, that's where they start targeting.
You know, it's a really interesting how the DEA correlates number of pills with some sort of financial metric. Do you believe that that comes from their lack of clinical understanding, that they try to equate the complexity of medicine into a drug transaction, or are they looking at something else?
Well, first of all, I don't think they have any clinical understanding.
True.
Let's go back a little farther. The Controlled Substance Act was designed to deal with the black drug industry that Congress created with the Harrison Narcotic Act in 1914. So in 1969, 1970, whenever the Controlled Substance Act, Congress is generally about 40% attorneys. So we have 40% of Congress passing a law to deal with a mental health issue. And we had a president who was both a racist and a bigot and an opioid.
President Nixon.
Tricky Dick was there. See, I know the vernacular from the 70s.
Very nice.
So in Congress, and Tricky Dick turned this mental health issue over to law enforcement.
Right.
And the only tool that law enforcement had to deal with was jail or prison. Right. So, and it's just evolved from there. And we're back to perpetuating the bureaucracy. And the size of the bureaucracy. So, you know, they, if you, and I hate to see, sometimes I hate this analogy, but it's true. You know, we are having a cop shot and killed almost every day in this country.
I know.
When is the last time you heard of a DEA agent getting shot or killed?
Yeah.
Because they're picking on the low-hanging fruit. They're going after physicians who generally are not armed to the teeth.
Yeah.
Unlike the cartels. The civil asset forfeiture law was originally designed for the DEA to confiscate the money of the cartels. Yeah. And they decided that, well, we can just confiscate any money we want to, because actually a lot of people don't understand this. Is when money's confiscated using the civil asset forfeiture law, the money is the actual criminal.
Okay, explain that a little bit.
Well, that's the way the law works out. Is the money is ill-gotten gains as far as the DEA is concerned.
Correct. So they use it to kind of assess the severity of the crime.
Well, but how can a pile of money defend themselves in the court of law?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's ass backwards type situation, and they you know, there was a story recently about a guy that took a bunch of money to go up north to buy some sort of equipment, and when he got there, it wasn't right, and went back home, and the agent at the gate noticed the cash in his carry-on and notified the DEA agents, and they seized all his cash.
Wow.
And that was just one of the stories I've heard, numerous ones. In fact, I have a graphic that I use on my blog is a picture out of stagecoach robberies, because it's basically what that is stagecoach robberies, and when the DEAs and other parts of the judicial system are seizing property. Another thing that nobody, few if any, ever wants to contribute a lot of some of this problem to. In 2001, Congress passed a law called the Decade of Pain Law. It created basically what ended up being the fifth vital sign.
Right.
And hospitals were to survey patients on discharge if their pain was managed well, and joint commissions who accredits all the hospitals, their accreditation allows them to bill for Medicare and Medicaid, which is usually, 70% of their money. This was a major standard. And if you flunk a major standard, hospitals up the creek financially.
Yeah.
That was not renewed in 2010. Not to get into politics, but the politics of Congress flipped between 2000 and 2010. It probably created, doctors not going to, prescribers not going to practice different medicine when his patient's in the hospital than when he sees them in the office.
Interesting. So you're saying that kind of the way the legislation worked and the changing thereof created a discrepancy between inpatient management of pain and outpatient management of pain.
Well, not really, because the physician's not going to change his process. If he's treating patients in the hospital, he's not going to flip his mindset when he goes to the office. And there were a number of prescribers who were greedy and took, did it for money purposes. Florida was a good example down there.
Yeah.
They claimed they had 90% of all the quote unquote oxy docs in the country. But there was probably a fair amount of careless refills on prescribing and careless refills on controlled substances over this decade of pain wall that physicians are pushed harder and harder to move faster and faster. And they were okay in refills when they probably shouldn't have on certain patients. And probably the family was complaining that the patient was taking too many and cut them off. And then the family's going, see, I told you you're an addict, because they went into withdrawal after being on there for several months. But that's a good reason why, abstinence rehab has a 5% success rate.
Yeah,
and that 5% success rate is because they were probably never an addict to begin with. They were allowed to take an opiate for too long and had withdrawal when he was cut off.
So that's an interesting point, particularly from a pharmacist's perspective. Why do you feel that at a policy level, the difference between an opioid dependent patient and an addict just doesn't exist? It's almost as if they don't understand that there's a certain clinical difference between the two.
Well, I can give you what I've used as an example before. You take two people, one who's a chronic pain patient and one who is potentially an addict, and you give them each 100 doses of an opiate. And you say, come back in a week, I want to see you. Well, I can almost guarantee you that the addict, the bottle is going to be empty. The chronic pain patient is going to find that sweet spot where they can function. You know, they're going to take just enough to get themselves, get rid of is enough pain to be functioning. Right. Probably have half or two thirds of the bottle left.
Yep.
Pretty simple case.
So you feel that a lot of the distinction between an addict, a dependent patient, really comes down to the patient's ability to manage and, in a sense, regulate how he or she takes the medications. How would that apply at a policy level when it seems like everything needs to be monitored or controlled? How do you explain, hey, let the patient self-regulate?
Well, the problem is where they end up with multiple doctors and multiple pharmacies.
Okay.
You know, at in one point in time, I don't think you use it much anymore, they had people that were labeled as pseudo addicts. And what they basically were people who the doctor gave them three doses a day, and they found out that six doses a day made them able to function. So they found another doctor to write them for three more doses a day, and they were functioning. They got their pain to the level that they could hold a job, do housework, work around the yard, but they were classified as pseudo addicts because they were basically undertreated. And you know, I dare anybody, you know, pain, depression, anxiety is all a subjective feeling. And, you know, when somebody said, I said, well, how do you physician know? Could you tell me how hungry that person is?
Right.
That's a subjective feeling. How about how thirsty they are?
So, you know, what's interesting is you talk about patient decision-making, subjectivity of pain and of dependency. These are terms that are well understood in the clinical world, but you also do a lot of legal consultation as well through your blog and directly individually. How do you explain this to the lawyers? How do you explain this to the defense attorneys, the prosecutors, the judges? How do they get this?
They probably won't, because they're dealing with a law that is not applicable. I mean, if you look at, let's take an example of the morphine milligram equivalent computations.
Okay.
My understanding is those things were developed using opiate naive patients with a single dose on acute pain, with no reference to what we know today as CYP450 opiate metabolism test, or pharmacogenomics PGX testing that will tell you if the patient is a slow, normal, fast, or ultra fast metabolizer.
Mm. So kind of not taking into account the individual, looking at more.
They're not taking, and besides, a single dose on an opiate naive patient, an acute pain, has nothing to do with a chronic pain patient who may have multiple sources of pain. And, you know, I don't know how many times I've had patients come back to me that are chronic pain patients, and they had surgery, and the pharmacist said, well, you're already on opiates.
Yeah, that's such a great point.
This is we're talking apples and oranges here, folks. You know,
well, let's delve into that a little bit. And I don't mean to cut you off, but I think you made such a great point when you differentiated between acute pain and chronic pain, acute clinical conditions, chronic conditions. And as you know, a lot of these guidelines were developed in the acute care setting, opioid naive patients, initial presentation, the ER, overdoses in the ER, mortality relative to the ER. Why do we confuse acute pain with chronic pain?
Because that's what the judicial system has told us. Wow. Oxycodone had been on the marketplace for a couple of decades in Tylox, Percocet, Percodan. I think that was the one, that was the only ones. There may have been another one I forgot about. It wasn't until 1996 that Purdue came out with a long-acting oxycodone. And you talk about numbers. It's been claimed that oxycodone or OxyContin was only 4% of all opiate prescriptions. But the Sacklers, you know, I read the other day, one person within the judicial system was really miffed that the Sacklers didn't get any prison time.
Right.
And they also wanted, you know, in our commercial system, the stockholders of a corporation, their assets are supposed to be distinctly separated from that of the assets of the corporation. But in this game plan with these lawsuits, with this opiate crisis.
You're kind of alluding to the Chapter 11 relief with the Purdue Pharma and kind of how there was the pretense and misapplication of the law that really just bucked the trend and how these similar lawsuits take place, correct?
Well, they wanted to get the Sacklers' personal assets into it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, they did it once before when GM went bankrupt and the court system validated the bonds, which are supposed to be guaranteed by the company's assets.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not the first time it's happened. And the J&J lawsuit in Oklahoma.
As a public nuisance ordinance.
Well, but Johnson & Johnson was just the wholesaler for raw opiate products to the rest of the industry.
Yeah. And not only that, the basis of the lawsuit was that Johnson & Johnson served as a public nuisance and violated the public nuisance ordinances.
That was a stretch.
Yeah.
that was a stretch. And it just seems very coincidentally strange that the money from the 1998 tobacco lawsuit is about ready to run out.
And that's an interesting point. And I think for the audience, can you talk a little bit about, you know, the funding that these agencies receive and where that funding comes from and how sometimes the lack of funding can incentivize, as you had mentioned, some of this curious behavior?
Well, the 1990, this was our first real lawsuit, big lawsuit on an industry selling a legal product. I forgot how many hundreds of billions of dollars it was paid out over 25 years. But it was settled, I think, in 1998, and it was paid over 25 years. So that money is going to dry up real soon. And so all of a sudden, these state AGs went to these law firms, didn't put any money of the states at risk because the law firms took it on a contingency basis. They'll take a cut of the action. And I just read a thing the other day that the tobacco lawsuits, even though they were designated where the money was to go, 95% got dumped into the state's coffers and yep. spent at will. So it seems like that we now had a lawsuit on another legal product because the states became financially addicted to that free money coming from that tobacco settlement.
And that's a really interesting point you mentioned. This kind of falls under broad aegis of a tort law, which is a kind of liability law, although that's not exactly apples to apples. But what you're alluding to essentially is this perverse incentive from the state to go after players with big pockets, whether they're truly liable or not, simply to kind of moralize a public health policy problem that they may not even be responsible for.
My crystal ball says the liquor industry's next.
They have a big lobby.
It's still so did the tobacco industry.
That is true.
I as I said, and what about pharma? That's got to have a pretty decent lobby as well. But I think the liquor industry is next. Wow. It's another legal product that kills 100,000 people a year, and or claims to contribute to the death or kills 100,000 people a year, and deep pockets, and it's. You know, it's that and tobacco has been allowed to persist because there's a damn good tax revenue stream off to the feds and the states just on sin taxes.
Wow. And you're right about that. Now, kind of wrapping up a little bit because we're getting short on time. If there's one thing you could say to a member of the DEA or the CDC or even now the FDA who may be listening to this podcast to really just kind of glean the full scope of the insight that you've obtained really over decades in this issue, what would you like that to be? What would you say?
Disregard anybody who was on that first CDC opiate guidelines committee. Believe everything they said was a lie. And everything they put in the hard copy was a lie and had an agenda.
You're referring to Prop.
Whoever was on that committee, they tried to keep that committee anonymous, which didn't last. And they didn't make they didn't publish what they're going to do before they did it. There was no public comment period. And some of us believe they did not even have the statutory authority to do it to begin with. But certain parties that the prop in particular and some of the anti-opiate groups, I don't know if it's they can't grasp or realize or get their brain around the fact that their family has a mental health gene in their gene pool.
Yeah. So it's attempting to create guidelines around a complex mental health issue that it doesn't work. And you've been one of the loudest voices in advocating for that. Real quickly, as an add-on question, because I think you brought up a really good point. What are they doing better now as they're revising the CDC guidelines that they didn't do before in the 2016 CDC guidelines?
My experience with anybody that opens up a wall or something to revise it, it always gets worse. and the only thing they could improve the CDC guidelines was to rescind them.
Yeah.
Revoke them. And let doctors be doctors. But give us tools to help recognize these patients that have mental health issues and direct help. But addicts generally don't want help until they've hit bottom.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to persuade them to get help generally. But I remember one time I was temping in this independent store for a 3-day weekend for this guy. And this patient, actually his patient's friend, was picking up and he was taking, I think it was 4 OxyContin 80 a day. And the dose was 2 BID. And I went out and he was sitting down in the chair out front. I went out to talk to him. And as I approached him, I could see him recoiling. And he said, I know he's taking too much. And this, I said, no, I don't give a damn about that. But I was suspecting he was an ultra fast metabolizer. I said, I might suggest that he takes 1 every 6 hours rather than 2 every 12. He might get better pain management. Well, you're changing his, I know I'm not changing his dose. Still taking 4 a day. It's just the timing. It's a little different. And the peaks are going to be a little lower and the valleys are going to be a little higher. And he might get a more level pain management. I'm getting more and more into timing of doses. The older I get, the more I get into timing and stuff. I get realizing timing is probably as important as the dose itself.
Yeah, particularly as you alluded to that, you know, every person metabolizes opioids differently. The timing, referring to the duration, is essentially the purpose of treating pain, in that you're not treating something that goes away, you're treating something that persists, and that the management of it is part of the treatment.
And the person's quality of life deteriorates in those peaks and valley, what I call a roller coaster.
Exactly.
You know, they're on a 4-hour pill And, you know, at three and a half hours, they're starting to go downhill. Yeah. And you've dosed at every six. You yeah. know, so they're really in the pit. Their quality of life is really in the pits. And then you guys are climbing back up again. So it's not, we're at year 51 on the war. There's too many people have too big an agenda and with closed minds.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that seems to be the reality of things.
I'm hoping that this you saw that lawsuit of $7 million in Louisville, Kentucky.
I did. Yeah. Okay. Can you tell that for the audience?
Well, this is about 15 miles from me. This was a gentleman from San Diego. He was visiting Louisville, Kentucky. And, he was a paraplegic from some sort of accident 11 years prior to that. He was visiting either on vacation or visiting relatives in Louisville, ran out of his opiates, reached out to a pain clinic, was wanting just some transition so he could get back to the West Coast. And the doctor cut his dose by 55%.
Wow.
The guy committed suicide. That was in 18. They just settled the lawsuit just a few weeks ago. The estate family was awarded $7 million. And what to me was important out of that $7 million was $3 million was awarded to his 12-year-old daughter for loss of companionship and consortium. I've been saying this for a year that if families, spouses sue a doctor for cutting a patient's med and they commit suicide and the family sues him, they're going to get blindsided.
Yeah.
And the only problem I see with this court case is this is a fairly large 12 office practice in Southern Indiana, Northern Kentucky. And I don't know how many employees they have, but it's got to be a bunch. If they appeal it and the appeal court settles, you know, our court systems, some judges tend to be more ruling on their personal opinion than rather than the law. And if they settle with
some,
the DOJ,
some or most,
well, an increasing number.
Yeah.
If they side with the DOJ and the DEA and overturn that, no law firm is going to touch a chronic pain patient's case.
I know. Yeah. A lot of people are depending on that case. A lot of people are relying on that case to serve as a precedent. You're right for that.
I've had several law firms reach out to me in the past, and they just haven't pulled the trigger.
Yeah,
because they're
afraid to. The court's not recognizing it.
It you know, but that one chart I have in the complications of comorbidity issues from under untreated pain, you can almost guarantee anybody with under untreated pain will end up with Addison's. The stress will cause increased cortisol production by the adrenals, and they'll eventually fail. You know, but I don't know how many patients that I've talked to, they've had strokes, they've had heart attacks, they've went into hypertensive crisis, and nobody seems to put the two together.
Yeah, you're right. Well, Steve, it was great speaking with you. Your insight is very valued, not just here at Daily Remedy, but across the pain and substance use dependency community. Thank you so much for what you do. You are a true asset. And before we go, can you just let the audience again know how they can get a hold of you and a little bit more about your blog?
My blog is pharmaciststeve.com. Last time I looked, there was over 9,000 posts on it.
Congratulations.
It's about 10 years. It's approaching 2.5 million page views. People ask me about something on there, and I go, it's on there somewhere. And WordPress isn't real good about searching stuff by search words. And I go, I can't find it. It's on there somewhere, but I can't find it. So my email's on there. My phone number's on there. But I've been forced to put my cell phone into automatic do not disturb from 10 o'clock at night to 8:30 in the morning, because those damn pain patients are up all night and have no propensity about who they call when.
Thank you for that, Steve. I appreciate your time.
And again, I'm sure a lot of them can relate to that.
Yeah. I think we all can. No, thank you so much for your time, Steve. Really appreciate that. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, bye-bye. Doctor. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye.